produces message.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Have you ever known someone who was really, really smart but couldn't tie their own shoes? Well, you know, we all remember people like that, people who had great ability intellectually but couldn't process that information so that it worked for them in life. Wisdom is knowledge using its head. Wisdom is the right use of what you know. Wisdom is a wonderful gift, and the Bible tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the book of Ecclesiastes has a lot to say about this subject, and we're going to jump into that in just a few moments as we begin to study the last section of Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And the title of today's lesson is Wisdom to be Thankful For. Now, let's get started with today's lesson, Wisdom to be Thankful For, and let's ask God to help us learn wisdom.
I want to begin with a story entitled, The Woodcutter's Wisdom. Once there was an old man who lived in a tiny village. Although poor, he was envied by all, for he owned a beautiful white horse. Even the king coveted his treasure. A horse like that had never been seen before. Such was its splendor, its majesty, and its strength. People offered fabulous prices for the steed, but the old man always refused. He would say, "This horse is not a horse to me. It's a person. How could you sell a person? He's a friend, not a possession. How could you sell a friend?" The man was poor and the temptation was great, but he never sold the horse. One morning he found that the horse was not in the stable, and all the village came to see him. "You old fool," they scoffed, "we told you someone would steal your horse. We warned you that you would be robbed. You are so poor, how could you ever hope to protect such a valuable animal? Would have been better to have sold him. You could have gotten whatever price you wanted. No amount would have been too high. Now the horse is gone and you've been cursed with misfortune." The old man responded, "Don't speak too quickly. Say only that the horse is not in the stable. That is all we know. The rest is judgment. If I've been cursed or not, how can you know? How can you judge?" The people contested, "Don't make us out to be fools. We may not be philosophers, but great philosophy is not needed. The simple fact is your horse is gone and it's a curse." The old man spoke again, "All I know is that the stable is empty and the horse is gone. The rest I don't know. Whether it be a curse or a blessing, I can't say. All we can see is a fragment. Who can say what will come next?" Well, the people of the village laughed. They thought that the man was crazy. They had always thought he was a fool. If he wasn't, he would have sold the horse and lived off the money. But instead, he was a poor woodcutter, an old man still cutting firewood and dragging it out of the forest and selling it. He lived hand to mouth in the misery of poverty. Now he had proven that he was indeed a fool. After 15 days, the horse returned. He hadn't been stolen. He'd run away into the forest. Not only had he returned, he brought a dozen wild horses with him. Once again, the village gathered around the woodcutter and spoke, "Old man, you were right and we were wrong. What we thought was a curse was a blessing. Please forgive us." The man responded, "Once again, you go too far. Say only that the horse is back. State only that a dozen horses returned with him, but don't judge. How can you know if this is a blessing or not? You see only a fragment. Unless you know the whole story, how can you judge? You read only one page of a book. Can you judge the whole book? You read only one word of a phrase. Can you understand the phrase? Life is so vast, yet you judge all of life with one page or one word. All you have is a fragment. Don't say this is a blessing, because no one knows. I am content with what I know. I am not perturbed but what I don't." "Maybe the old man is right," they said one to another. So they said little, but down deep they knew he was wrong. They knew it was a blessing. 12 wild horses had returned with one horse. With a little bit of work, the animals could be broken and trained and sold for a lot of money. The old man had a son, an only son. The young man began to break the wild horses, and after a few days, he fell off one of the horses and broke both legs. Once again, the villagers gathered around the old man and cast their judgments. "You were right," they said. "You proved you were right. The dozen horses were not a blessing. They were a curse. Your only son has broken his legs. Now in your old age, you have no one to help you. Now you are poorer than ever." The old man spoke again. "You people are obsessed with judging. Don't go so far. Say only that my son broke his legs. Who knows if it's a blessing or a curse? No one knows. We only have a fragment. Life comes in fragments, you know." And so it happened that a few weeks later, the country engaged in war against a neighboring country. All the young men of the village were required to join the army. Only the son of the old man was excluded because he was injured. Once again, the people gathered around the old man, crying and screaming because their sons had been taken. There was little chance they would return. The enemy was strong. The war would be a losing struggle, and they would never see their sons again. "You were right, old man," they wept. "God knows you were right. This proves it. Your son's accident was a blessing. His legs may be broken, but at least he's with you. Our sons are gone forever." The old man spoke again. "It is impossible to talk with you. You always draw conclusions. No one knows if it's a blessing or a curse. No one is wise enough to know. Only God knows." The woodcutter had captured the essence of Solomon's word in Ecclesiastes 7. Sometimes crying's better than laughing. Sometimes funerals are better than weddings. Sometimes a man's dying day is better than his birthday. Criticism is more valuable than compliments. The long way around's better than the shortcut. And there is no such thing as the good old days. If life is really that upside down, then how can wisdom possibly help me? Solomon is going to teach us that wisdom is not knowing what you cannot know. Wisdom is not trying to judge the book by the cover. Wisdom is understanding that you have only a fragment. Only God has the entire manuscript. How blessed we are if we have the wisdom of the woodcutter and the wisdom of Solomon. Here in the last half of chapter 7, we discovered two gigantic reasons for gratitude. If we have wisdom, we should be thankful for the perspective of wisdom and for its power in our lives. First of all, in verses 11 through 18, Solomon teaches us that we should thank God for the perspective of wisdom. Wisdom may not solve all of our problems. It may not make all of the tough things good. But wisdom gives us an understanding of what's going on. It helps us to see things in perspective. For instance, wisdom helps us to deal with prosperity. Verses 11 and 12 say, "Wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense, but the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it." It is better, said Solomon, to have wisdom than to have a good fortune or a good inheritance. Wisdom does not depreciate, nor is it subject to inflation. And Solomon says that a person who has wisdom and wealth is doubly blessed. In fact, it becomes his defense twice over. Wisdom gives life to those who have it. That is what Solomon said in Proverbs. That's what he says here. Proverbs 8:35. He says, "For whoever finds me, wisdom, finds life and obtains favor from the Lord." According to Solomon, wisdom is like a shelter to those who have it, and it's a greater source of security than money could ever be. It is amazing how very few people there are who both have wealth and wisdom. Have you noticed? But a person who is wealthy without wisdom can end up being the most miserable creature on God's green earth. And I've met a few of them. Have you? They have wealth and they have no wisdom. Wealth has become for them a curse instead of a blessing. Solomon says that wisdom is something we should be grateful for because it gives perspective to us. And wisdom helps us to understand that prosperity is not the end all of everything. That if you have prosperity and you don't have the wisdom to enjoy it, you're better off to be poor. Next, he says that wisdom helps us to deal with providence. Notice verses 13 and 14. "Consider the word of God. For who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him." Solomon says, the truth of the matter is that affliction is the appointment of God, and it's the crooked thing we can't fix. We like to, wouldn't we? We'd like to straighten out all the crooked spaces. I actually wrote a book one time called The Bend in the Road. And you know, it's wonderful to know that God is with you in the bend in the road, but how many of you would do what I do? If you could, you'd straighten out the bend and you'd never go there. You wouldn't want the crooked thing. Solomon says that the crooked thing is adversity. And the truth of the matter is that affliction is disappointment of God. And the crooked thing that we think needs straightening is the present of affliction and adversity. Walter Kaiser, who is a wonderful scholar, has paraphrased these verses that we just read like this. And I want to read his paraphrase. Listen carefully. Look with wonder, admire, and silently wait for the result of God's work. The contrasts of life are deliberately allowed by God so that men should ultimately develop a simple trust and dependence in God. For prosperity and the goods from God's hand, be thankful and rejoice. But in adversity and the crookedness of life, think. Reflect on the goodness of God and the comprehensiveness of His plan for men. We all can get all excited about the prosperity we've enjoyed. Maybe you've had a good financial year. Maybe things are looking up for you. But you know, what Solomon teaches us is that we ought to thank God that we have learned from the troubles we've had too. Job one time, when he was going through the loss of everything that he experienced, you remember he lost everything all in one short period of time. His family, all of his funds, his health, everything. The only thing was left was his wife. And often thought that God leaving his wife was the biggest curse he ever got, because she was a real pain. And she was chiding him one day about all of the suffering he was going through and telling him what a terrible thing it was that God had treated him this way. And Job turned to his wife. I can almost see this conversation in my mind's eye. Job chapter 2, verse 10. Job turned to his wife and he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." What a wise man he was. We all rejoice when everything's good and we're so thankful. But can you learn from God how to be thankful that in the midst of the storm, God's there? I'll tell you the truth. God is never closer to you than he is when you're going through adversity. And you almost feel sorry for people who have never been in that place to see and to sense the wonderful provision of God. Warren Wiersbe, one of my good friends, has a sharp pen, and he wrote this. He said, "God balances our lives by giving us enough blessings to keep us happy and enough burdens to keep us humble. If all we had were blessing in our hands," he said, "we'd fall right over. So the Lord balances the blessing in our hands with burdens on our backs." That helps us keep steady. And as we yield to Him, sometimes we can even turn the burdens into blessings. Now, do you get a visual picture of that? What would happen to you if God just gave you all blessings? You'd all be bent over. You wouldn't be able to walk. But God gives you blessings, and then He gives you burdens. And now you can kind of stand up, and you can be straight. So be thankful for the wisdom God gives you to understand His providence in your life. And then Solomon adds, if I might paraphrase, don't even think about it. You will never figure God out anyway, so don't even try to think about it. Don't worry about it. He knows the future, you don't, so just let God be God and you be you. Wisdom to deal with prosperity, wisdom to deal with providence. And then he adds his third thought in verses 15 through 18, wisdom to deal with the puzzles of life. Now, you know, life is full of puzzles. Did you know that? Every day there's a puzzle. Things you can't figure out. I'm about ready to start our annual puzzle at the Jeremiah household. I'm not going to tell you the percentage of these that we ultimately finish, but we always start them. And we always get the square part done. In fact, it's almost a fight to see who gets to do the straight pieces, because they're easy. But when you get in the middle, oh my, there are a lot of puzzles in life. One of the puzzles he talks about in verse 15 is the puzzle of reversed rewards. Notice, "I have seen everything," he said, "in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs life in his wickedness." We've dealt with this one before in this series, so I won't stay here long. But why do the wicked prosper and why do the righteous suffer? Solomon says. He wants us to know that we are only seeing the outside of this puzzle, that we must get beneath the surface of this in order to understand what God is up to. And the fact is, we never are able to do all of that in this life. Listen to what King Solomon says in the 11th chapter of this book we are studying, and verse 5. He said, "As you do not know what is the way of the wind, or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child, so you do not know the works of God who makes everything." You don't. You can't figure it out. Does that bother you? You know, it first bothered me, but now it doesn't bother me anymore. It makes me just so excited that I have a God who's so awesome that in my infinite wisdom, which is pretty finite, I can't comprehend Him. Why? His ways are higher than my ways. His thoughts than my thoughts. He's the inscrutable God of history. That's why I worship Him. If I could fully understand Him, He would be no more of a God than I am. He's the God of history, the God of providence, the God I worship, the God I give gratitude for, all that He does, even though I don't always understand it. We know the adversity comes to good people. Some of the best people I know lost everything that they owned. Why would God do that? We know that God is loving. We know that God cares about His children. And at the same time, we know that God is powerful. He can do anything He wants. How God's love and His power are blended together to create His will, we do not know and we cannot know. Solomon says we need to accept it. Remember, do not let what you can't understand keep you from enjoying what you have from God. Remember the woodcutter. You only see a fragment. Remember what he said? You people are obsessed with judging. Don't go so far. Who knows if it's a blessing or a curse? No one knows. We only have a fragment. Life comes in fragments, says the woodcutter. Well, that's the puzzle of reversed rewards. And now we come to the puzzle of righteous rhetoric. And this is really one of the most difficult passages in the book of Ecclesiastes, and it's the most misinterpreted passage in the entire book. Listen to what Solomon says in verses 16 and 18, and you won't have to ask me why it's misinterpreted after you read it with me. Do not be overly righteous. Do not be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp this and also not remove your hand from the other, for he who fears God will escape them all. Now, many liberal scholars say, oh, here's the proof text. What you need is moderate holiness. Let's all applaud mediocrity. Don't be very good, and don't be very bad. Just be medium. Have you ever talked to anybody like that? Sometimes you talk to somebody about their walk with the Lord. You say, do you know God? And what do they say? Well, I'm not as bad as a lot of people I know, and I'm surely not as good as some people I know. I guess I'm just sort of medium. They use this as their text. I'll tell you what, medium won't get you into heaven. It won't. Medium will send you straight to hell. You can be medium and get there just as fast as if you're wicked. Because it's not saying just be partially good, don't be totally bad. What Solomon is saying here is in the Hebrew language, it's reflexive. And he's saying, whatever you do, don't go around bragging about how good you are. And don't go around bragging about how humble you are. Don't be filled with righteousness that's self-centered. Don't be wise in your own eyes, as he mentions in the book of Proverbs. Don't be going around telling everybody how good you are. And on the other hand, don't be going around bragging about how bad you are. That's not where it's coming from. The fact is, this verse is not cautioning against being too righteous. It's warning us against righteous rhetoric that's not backed up by righteous living. Solomon has made it clear in verse 20 that there aren't any righteous people. So he can't be talking here about true righteousness. He's speaking out against the self-righteousness of the hypocrite and the false wisdom of the proud. And in both cases, these sins lead to destruction. The way to avoid the ditch of self-righteousness and false humility is to stay in the middle. And the middle of the road is verse 18. It is good for you that you grasp this, and also not remove your hand from the other, for he who fears God will escape them all. Have you ever been around a self-righteous person? Oh my, our churches are full of them. I mean, you can see it dripping off of them when they walk up to you. They even have a little church voice. Have you noticed? oh, you know, God spare us from those folks. I read a story about a pastor who had a guy in his church who was having an affair with his wife, and he got caught. He was humbled and confessed it, and got everything right, got right home, and he went off and went a couple Bible classes, and he came back spouting all kinds of self-righteous rhetoric. But the pastor wasn't doing this right, and the pastor wasn't doing this right. And the pastor grabbed hold of his arms, looked him right in the face, and he said, I liked you better when you were an adulterer. At least you were humble. You understand that lesson? He's saying, don't get caught up in self-righteousness. And don't be walking around bad-mouthing yourself all the time. What you need to do is walk in the fear of God. That's what Solomon is saying. Stay off each of the side roads and stay on the center road. Fear God and walk with Him. And He says, you better grab hold of that one. Grasp that one with your hands.
Amen. You know, I have been doing a very intense and in-depth study on the fear of God, and I think it may be one of the most surprising and useful studies I've ever done. It is at the core of everything in life. In fact, when people ask me today, what's wrong with America? I say, we've lost our sense of the fear of God. And many people look at me and they think, yeah, that's right. We no longer fear God as we once did as a nation. Well, fearing God is not only good for a nation, it's good for people too. It's good for people in the nation. It's good for us if we want to learn wisdom. Wisdom is the beginning that comes when we fear God. And we'll be back with more of this from Ecclesiastes chapter 7 when we get together right here in this same place on this same good station tomorrow.
This is Mark Larson. Join us tomorrow as we continue the series Searching for Heaven on Earth on Turning Point with Dr. David Jeremiah.